Welcome, new and old friends. My name is 242, and today 42 got us two stories. We start with a man who goes into the woods looking for something a bit cryptid, and finds exactly what he was looking for, but at the same time, more than he was looking for. Lastly, I'm helped with a few other narrators to tell a story about a guy who's stuck in a trailer park and wishes to get out from his terrible family life. Please remember to like, subscribe, share, and comment. It's a new year, which means it's time for some new stories. With all that being said, turn off your lights, make sure your doors and windows are locked. Things are about to get spooky. The Michigan Dogman by Frostbire. I've always been fascinated by urban legends and tales of supernatural creatures. I've heard of the Dogman since I was young, when I first heard the legends playing on the radio. Mysterious creatures said to roam the forest of the Great Lakes region, and with my fascination came a sense of wanting to find the creature and see it for myself if it was really out there. Armed with a curious mind and a flashlight, I set out to explore the woods near my hometown. It was an overcast night, with only a dim glow of the stars to guide my path. As I ventured deeper into the forest, I couldn't shake off the feeling that I was being watched. Every rustle of leaves and snaps of twigs sent shivers down my spine. But I pressed on, my curiosity overpowering my unease. Little did I know how much of a mistake it was to ignore my instincts. After what felt like hours of wandering, I stumbled forward, an eerie silence blanketing the forest, as if a switch was flipped and all the sound in the world disappeared. Something drew me towards it, an invisible force urging me to step closer. That's when I surveyed my surroundings in detail and saw it, a pair of glowing amber eyes staring back at me from the shadows. My heart skipped a beat as the creature revealed itself. A massive canine-like figure, standing upright on two legs. Its fur was matted and dark, and its eyes glowed with an otherworldly light. It was a dogman, and it had fixed its gaze upon me. A primal fear surged through my veins as I stumbled back, dropping my flashlight in the process, and with it but a moment's hesitation, I turned and ran as fast as my legs could carry me. The sound of heavy footsteps pounding behind me growing louder and closer with each passing second. I could hear its snarls and the sharp snap of its jaws, hungry for the chase. My breath grew ragged and my muscles screamed in protest, but the adrenaline fueled my desperate sprint. Branches whipped against my face and the forest floor seemed to rise up to trip me, but I pushed through, determined to escape the clutches of the monstrous dogman. My lungs burned and my vision blurred as I reached the edge of the woods. My house stood just a few yards away, its light providing a beacon of hope. Summoning the last reserves of my strength, I sprinted across the yard and flung open the front door. I slammed it shut, panting heavily as I leaned against it, my heart racing in my chest. I felt a mixture of relief and terror as I looked through the window and saw the dogman standing at the edge of the clearing. Its gaze fixed upon me. Its mouth curled into a wicked snarl, revealing sharp, glistening teeth, in what looked like a cruel and deranged smile. For a moment, we locked eyes, a battle of will between human and beast. I know I had escaped, but the encounter had left an indelible mark on my soul. The dogman had shown me the darkness lurking just beyond the realm of our understanding, and it was a sight I would never forget. To this day, I'm plagued with the memories of that night. The image of the dogman's glowing eyes and sinister grin haunts my dreams, a constant reminder of the terrors that exist in the shadows. I warn anyone who dares to venture into the Michigan wilderness, beware the dogman's domain. It may be an urban legend to some, but for those who encounter its malevolence, it is all too real. The forest hides its secrets well, and the dogman waits patiently for the next victim. Ever since then, I haven't been able to look at the woods without a shudder going down my spine, hoping to not see the amber eyes staring back at me. If I were to give you all any advice, it would be, do not go out at night. They don't tell you that the worst part of the job is the smell. After all these years I've worked and all the people I wasn't able to save, I can't enjoy barbecue or fire pit, can't go camping, can't have a fucking s'more without thinking of their burning bodies. Don't Tell a Soul by Lofo.
Who the fuck was that, Jess?
I could hear my mom's latest boyfriend scream at her through the thin walls on our single wide trailer.
For the last time, you know him! His name is Kenny. Nothing happened!
I could hear my mom scream back. Her voice was hoarse, trying to hold back tears. I listened to a nightly back and forth while switching my gaze from a broken, oscillating fan in the corner of my broom closet of my bedroom, and out into the dark Kentucky countryside through my bedroom window. I never liked listening to those arguments, but at some point, they became so regular that I was able to tune them out most of the time. Some nights, like tonight, were different. I found myself hanging off of every word to a near pointless argument that I cared next to nothing about. They always ended one of two ways. The first was a round of equal parts rough and loud makeup sex, and the other was Jimmy getting kicked out. At the same time, my mom spends the rest of the weekend at Gators, the local dive bar for trailer trash like us, known for serving almost any paying customer, regardless of age, before coming home with a new boyfriend who never had less than two DUIs. After the first bottle of whiskey smashed against the wall, I decide I didn't want to stay in the trailer that night. It wasn't unusual. I had a habit of crashing with friends for weeks on end, and in 1996, there was nothing I could be tracked with, not that anyone would have. I cracked open my window about halfway and slid out into the cold November air. I stuffed my hands in the pouch of my hoodie and began to walk to the center of the trailer park. As I drew closer, an ever-present flickering glow began to reflect off the vinyl sidings, and grew stronger and stronger against the side of each passing single wide. Rounding the last trailer is met with a Sunday bonfire. Over a week, most people save up all of their excess paper and cardboard waste to burn every Sunday night. Around the fire sat three slowly decaying couches, the upholstery looking more like rags loosely tossed over the frame and cushions. Jim sat on the closest couch, back to me, nursing whatever the cheapest beer at the gas station had been that day. His eyes were fixed on the ever-dying fire, only 15 minutes at most from turning into dying embers. Without saying a word, I grabbed the last beer from the six-pack and took a seat beside him to watch the fire die. We sat for maybe 5 minutes before he finally said anything.
New boyfriend?
He wasn't looking at me, still fixated on the fire, answered by taking another long sip.
Damn.
He took the final sip before crushing the can and tossing it into the fire to deform even further slowly. He stood to his feet and stretched an arm out to help me up.
Come on.
I took his hand and pulled myself up, becoming a little lightheaded as I gained my footing. I followed him without another word to his rusting, rust-red Ford pickup parked behind his trailer. Jimmy had become like an older brother. He was almost 7 years older than me. He was growing facial hair while I was still figuring out multiplication. When he had gotten his license and his family kicked him out, we didn't see much of him for almost a year. Then one day he pulled right back into Bronze Anchor Meadows, the sign even more decrepit than when he had left. He marched right up to a trailer, keys in hand, and walked inside. No one knew what exactly he did for work, having known him for as long as I had. I guess he did whatever he was paid. He never worked for one sole person or company. When he finally came back, he was almost like a god to the younger kids. Getting a single wide all to yourself at 18? Unheard of for us. Looking back on it, it's almost laughable what we thought the heights of luxury was. I climbed into the passenger seat before slamming the door that was so badly in need of an oil shut. He slid the key into the ignition and shifted into first before pulling out of the park. I reached under my seat and pulled out the small shoebox filled with cassettes. His selection was small, Motorhead, Metallica, and a few other bootleg country tapes mixed in with everything from black metal to Wu-Tang.
Do you have anything good?
I asked. My voice was hoarse with disuse. I hadn't thought about it, but that was probably the first time I had spoken in 2 days.
That is it,
Jimmy said, motioning to the box, not taking his eyes off the road.
Make something good out of it.
I kept pawing around the box until I settled on Nirvana's Nevermind album. I opened the case and slid the worn 5-year-old cassette into the filthy tape deck. When I hit play, track 1, Smells Like Teen Spirit, roared to life. I adjusted the volume and asked,
"Where are we going?"
Jimmy stayed silent.
"Are we just driving, or..."
He cut me off.
"You want to make some money?"
His question caught me off guard. I hesitated.
"How much?"
He started doing math in his head. Every half second that passed felt longer and longer. Nirvana was completely tuned out.
"I'd say around 25 grand each."
I felt my soul leave my body for a moment. I never heard someone talk about that much money, let alone seen it.
"How?"
"I'm sorry?"
He finally looked over at me.
"How are we getting it?"
"You remember when I took off a few years ago?"
"Yes."
"I met this guy. He collects things."
"What things?"
I half expected him to tell me we're on the way to rob an art gallery.
"All kinds of stuff. He showed me around his trophy room once. All kinds of things. A lot of old things. Most of them looked like they were about 5 seconds from turning into dust."
He seemed to be excited to be telling me all about this, like the weight was finally being lifted off his shoulders.
"Nate, this is your fucking payday, man."
He wasn't wrong. $35,000 can carry me a lot further than the trailer park I'd spent most of my life in. I shut my mouth. I didn't know how to respond, or if I should respond. This was how he made his money. He was nothing better than a thief. He must have sensed this because he switched gears, trying to reassure me that everything was on the up and up.
"Listen, all I'm doing is putting some cool things in a museum. Like those Indiana Jones movies you like. No one gets hurt, and I get paid. Win-win, right?"
Looking back, it was clear that he was doing his best to convince himself more than me that he was still a good person who was doing a morally just thing. I caved.
"What is it?"
He pulled up to a gas station, expectantly asking if I was in. It felt like some sort of shitty Ocean's 11 parody. I didn't know how to answer. Every fiber in my bones screamed at me not to.
"Nothing changes if nothing changes."
His words ripped me right from my mental pros and cons list.
"What?"
"You don't like it at home, right?"
He was right.
"You're never gonna leave if you keep flowing through your life. Am I wrong?"
He wasn't.
"This is your chance to change that."
He slid the gear shifter into park, got out, and began moving towards the building to pay. I looked at the fuel gauge, half a tank left. He just wanted me to think about it. He knew how deep and how well he had braided those words into my brain. When he finally came back, beer in hand, I answered him. I was in, and I wanted to be. Dollar signs were the only thing I saw, the only thing I wanted to see.
"What are we taking?"
"The guy wants this charm."
He held up a circle with his fingers as he started the engine again.
"It's a Haitian thing."
"Haitian?"
The word felt odd leaving my mouth, like my mouth had never made that sound before. I mouthed it a few more times to shake off the unfamiliarity.
We're robbing Haitians.
No, just a religion.
I began to ask another question before he cut me off.
Look, I don't know what it's called, or how old it is, or whatever else you want to ask. All I know is that some group has set up camp on an old plantation a few hours away. They've kept to themselves mostly. They hold these rituals or something. He showed me photos, but I didn't get it. Something to do with chicken's blood?
Chicken's blood?
With every new sentence, this 25,000 sound less and less real.
Yes, chicken's blood. Look, I don't get it either.
We spent the rest of the night talking about this. The more Jimmy talked, the more clear it became just how little he knew about what we were being paid to find. Again, looking back, I should have backed out right then and there. But money is a fickle thing. People will choose money over their soul 9 times out of 10. This has always been and always will be the case. From Judas all the way up to me, the cycle will always repeat, long after I'm dead and gone. He dropped me off that night close to sunrise. Questions still dart through my mind at a million miles an hour. 3 days later, he picked me up again, this time with another guy, Grant. Tall and lanky, dressed in dark jeans and a black construction hoodie, similar to Jimmy, sat in the passenger seat. I climbed over him and took my place in the middle of the bench seat before taking off. The plantation was only 50 miles past the Kentucky-Tennessee border. We parked the car at a local diner and set off on foot for the 3-mile hike across a privatized forest and a storm evacuation trail. When we finally got close, the other two stopped. Grant pulled a handgun out of his waistband and pulled back the slider to make sure that there was a round in the chamber. Jimmy pulled one out from his waistband and the other from his backpack he had slung over his left shoulder. He handed me one while checking the chamber on his.
What do we need these for?
What do you think?
When Grant finally spoke more than 2 words to me, they were more mocking. He did his best to put up a wall for everyone. Mine just happened to be well constructed out of snide remarks and contempt.
You said no one would get hurt.
I said, grabbing the gun from him.
And they won't.
Jimmy said, tucking the gun back into his waistband.
Just some insurance.
He put both hands up and let loose a grin constructed of his crooked and ever-darkening teeth. His warped smile was hard to find comforting. I tucked the gun back into the back of my waistband and covered it with my shirt, a black band shirt I had bought for $2 about a year before at a thrift store. We kept walking. Kazoon vines kept wrapping around my feet, forcing me to stop every few seconds and either yank them from the ground with a quick and forceful tug or by rolling my ankle until they fell off naturally. By the time we finally crest the ridge, we had a clear view of what I will forever refer to as a compound. A large metal fence, topped in barbed wire, surrounded by several small one-room cabins that didn't look to have been refurbished since their construction in the late 1800s. People moved in and around each cabin and each other swiftly. Each person moved in an inherent sense of purpose. Some carried large boxes or tools, and others just moved. From a distance, they resembled a colony of ants. We sat perched on the hilltop for what felt like years in complete silence, watching the people go about their daily lives. Just from sitting there, everyone seemed complete and fulfilled. No one person inside the fence seemed unhappy or dissatisfied with their life. They had their own chores around the compound to do, and at night they slept in one of the former slave quarters with their families. After the sun finished setting, Jimmy was the first to move. He flipped his bag around and unzipped the top pouch before pulling out a pair of rust bolt clippers that looked like they had just spent the last several years in neglect. Once we made our way through the fence, we left the gate hanging open in case we felt the need for a quick exit. As I passed through, it snagged my shirt on a sharp edge of the chain link, tearing a small hole along my ribcage. I wrestled it free and kept my place in the middle of the pack. We found ourselves staring at the back of the compound. About a mile straight ahead sat the rotting white chapel at the top of the hill, its sides having been decorated with all sorts of symbols meant to ward off evil spirits or whatever these people were supposed to believe in. When we made our way up to the base of the back of the staircase of the chapel, things felt wrong. My consciousness hadn't gotten to me yet, but everything felt too easy. I let these thoughts overcome my subconscious, and soon they were all I could think about. They raced across my mind as Jimmy cut the padlock to the cellar door that sat next to the staircase. Grant helped by lifting the large oak doors and shoving it into the mixture of grass and dirt that the hinges allowed it to reach. Jimmy pulled a flashlight out of his bag of wonders, and Grant flicked a Zippo open to light his cigarette before descending the staircase, lighter in hand. I followed behind, stopping to take in the outside world, taking note of every detail I could before lowering. Everything from the symbols carved into the earth to the bonfire in the center of the living quarters that is now just a smoldering pile of ash and charred wood. Ducking my head below the large beam, nearly smacking it as I did so, my eyes struggled to adjust to the suffocating darkness. Only focusing on the two separate light sources, frantically scanning each corner of the room, looking for a way upstairs. Eventually, Grant's lighter illuminated the rusty remains of what had once been a ladder. The bolts hung freely from the brackets that were clinging to the ladder frame by the ancient welds. Jimmy shook it to test its strength before remarking that it felt good enough. Jimmy went up first, lifting the hatch at the top just enough to peek through. The light above spilled across his face before he pushed the hatch the rest of the way to open and climb through. When I finally had my turn to surface, I was met with two lines of candles stretching for what seemed like miles. In reality, it was really only 30 feet or so. The lines ran parallel to make room for someone to walk. It reminded me of a wedding or any formal event that involved someone walking down an aisle. The hatch we ascended through was located in the very back of the rather large one-room chapel directly behind the altar. When I finally found my footing, I spent an extra few seconds taking in the entire room, allowing a few quick breaths to calm the ever-rising wave of anxiety I had allowed to grow in the cellar. My body rocked back and forth on the aging wood flooring, laying out a slow creak with every small shifting of my weight. To my left, Jimmy and Grant had found another handmade wooden cabinet locked shut with another padlock that seemed like no match for the neglected wire cutters after a few attempts. My eyes scanned the windows as they opened the cabinet doors and began rummaging through its contents. As I finished the first lap, my eyes stopped on the now roaring bonfire, where what seemed like seconds ago was nothing more than a smoldering pile of ashes. I tried for their attention, getting shrugged off as they pulled out pieces of dirty cheesecloth wrapped around a large disc. I yelled and Grant smacked his head on the top of the inside of the cabinet.
"What?"
he yelped, holding his hand to the back of his head. I pointed out the window and their eyes widened in sync. Never been religious. As we began to turn heel and run out the door, Grant refused to follow. I was baptized by my grandmother when I was first born, but I quickly fell out of the church. I've always found that most jaw-dropping moments are when the atheists drop to their knees. I was no exception. I began mouthing the Hail Mary over and over again. I began to do this when my eyes caught what he was looking at. Amongst the splintering rafters of the chapter, sat perched a tall and gangly creature. The emaciated figure was hunched over, its knees in its chest, as its massive bony hands clasped firmly around the wooden beams as if they were a twig. Its face was difficult to describe, as if every person I had ever met were formed into one being. It smiled at me with perfect snow-white teeth that clashed with the rancid filth that covered its skin in a thick layer. Its hair drifted with the wind in thin strands. With its head cocked to the side, I began to backpedal away from it slowly, maintaining eye contact as I did so. When I finally built up the courage to turn my back, I was met with Jimmy yanking on the handle to the back door. When that didn't work, he resolved to kick it down. When that also failed, I turned around to see the thing standing a hair away from paralyzed Grant. Now that it stood on its own feet, I was able to guess that it was no less than 8 feet tall. It stared into him unblinking, its slow, methodical breathing turning into fast, deep panting. Its chest inflamed more and more with each breath, rising and falling faster with every passing second. I took too long staring at it because when I was finally able to move my eyes from this sudden fixation, Jimmy was gone. Next to me, the hatch was wide open. I looked back one more time and Grant had a hand wrapped around his mouth, the fingers clasped at the back of his scalp. He tried his best to scream, but was only able to manage a soft, muffled whimper. The creature lifted its other hand up and brushed it down the front of Grant's face. He had stopped trying to scream by now. Now he stood there panting in unison with the thing, eyes wide. It dropped its grin. I don't know what's more unsettling, the ending rows of perfect teeth or the complete absence of any emotion on his face. It lifted 2 fingers with its unoccupied hand and began tracing the features of Grant's face. I ducked my head below the floor when it slowly pushed towards his eyes. I slammed the hutch shut above me, but that didn't stop the shrill. Pain wailed from penetrating the floor. The ladder gave out from the wall as I did my best to scurry down as fast as possible. I was pinned to the floor. It must have weighed only 60 pounds at most, but I still found myself struggling to lift it from my chest. After struggling to roll out from under it, I managed to shove it off to the side, leaving a thin, deep, and long slash down my forearm. Blood began to emanate from it almost immediately. I held on to what I could and squeezed as hard as my hand would let me in a futile attempt to stop the now gushing blood from pouring out of my arm. I looked over. The cellar door was left wide open. I pawed at my waist, hoping against hope that I had actually worn a belt for once, but I hadn't. The sudden realization led to my heart racing even faster, thus more blood spilled from my arm. I began to hobble my way to the steps. My vision began to go in and out of focus. I began to feel my legs go numb underneath me as the saturation of everything around me shifted. I was barely able to pull myself up over the last step. I flopped onto my back and stared at the quickly darkening stars as I tried my best to make right with God through my delirium. I was halfway through my half-hearted plea for mercy when everything faded out. The only way I can best describe the feeling after waking up is shock. I felt everything in my body seize as if I had come back from the dead all at once. The next few things I noticed were the inability to move my hands or legs. The next was the bizarre heat that ran up and down my entire body, coming from the left of me. I rolled my head over, and I was met with a bonfire only 3 feet away from my nose. I had been tied down. People were crowded around me as I lay unable to move. I thrashed against my restraints to no avail. The adrenaline had worn off by now. My arm burned internally, and every movement felt like I was rubbing glass into the wound. Looking around, I could see several people gathered around me in a circle that wrapped around the fire. No one said a word, instead chose to stare at me in silence. I thrashed against my restraints against the pain, all the while screaming whatever obscenities came to mind at whoever could listen. I stopped my thrashing when I noticed the skin and eyeless corpse of Grant impaled on a stake that was covered in now congealed and burnt blood that stretched into the sky from his throat in the center of the fire. Slowly, his exposed muscles and nerves charred darker and darker. I couldn't see past his waist, but I could imagine his feet were no more than ash and bone by that point. From behind me, I could hear Jimmy. I couldn't see, but judging by the noise, he had also just woken up. However, instead of leaving him in his restraints, they cut him free and carried him into my view. Still completely silent. One man in a large, filthy, Catholic-style white gown. As he stepped closer to the fire with the aid of a walking stick, he removed the disc from inside the gown and delicately unwrapped it from the cloth. As he did so, a small murmur broke out amongst the crowd that slowly came together to form a hushed prayer in a language I had never heard before. He lifted his stick and affixed the disc to it through the hole in the center and placed it into the fire before turning around to face Jimmy and the two men that were holding him. He knelt down to eye level with him and placed his palm onto Jimmy's forehead and began to say a prayer. I pulled around my restraints to gather my range of motion to find that I could no longer feel the gun I had tucked underneath my shirt. Eventually, the priest stood back up and grabbed the now white-hot branding iron by the leather-wrapped handle. The two men holding Jimmy on his knees stood him up to face me.
Don't you touch him!
Tears welled up in his eyes.
Keep your hands off of him!
One of the men holding him pulled out a small pocket knife and held it to his throat. For one final moment, we locked eyes before he mouthed,
I'm sorry.
The serrated blade ripped across his esophagus. A large, interrupted stream of black, red gore spilled into the bucket that had been placed at his feet. I began to cry and thrashed even harder at my restraints, causing a few of the fresh stitches in my arm to burst. Jimmy dropped limply into the uncut grass where the blood continued to pool after the bucket had been adequately filled. When the priest walked over, he began praying louder. A woman walked up from behind me and ripped my shirt more from where the fence had snagged it earlier, before placing the bucket that had just been at Jimmy's feet, before disappearing back into the crowd. The priest stopped his prayer and lunged the iron into my now exposed skin. Immediate sweltering pain. I tried to tug away, but that only made the burning worse as he pushed in the iron even more. The stench of melting flesh filled my nostrils. When that failed, I resorted to the one thing I could control. I screamed at the top of my lungs until my throat burned more than my abdomen. The crowd began to chant something in the same language the priest had been praying in. He pulled the iron away and dunked it into a bucket of water below me, the steam bellowing up and obscuring his face. I began hyperventilating while trying to slow my breathing between bursts of frantic and uncontrolled panting. He raised the bucket just above the burn and poured it over. The blood turned the pain from burning into retching. The body isn't meant to fluctuate temperatures that much in such a short amount of time. I rolled away from him as he set the bucket back down. He stepped towards my head and placed a hand on my forehead before beginning to recite the same prayer he had for Jimmy. I yanked my right arm upwards and felt the zip tie restraint give slightly. I pulled it as hard and as fast as I could until it gave up. I mustered every bit of strength I had in my left arm and I hit the priest as I rolled over and forced the other zip tie apart. My feet came out even easier, only tied down with 2-foot-long sections of rope held together with a loose square knot. Adrenaline had more than kicked in by this point and I darted behind the cabins towards the general direction where we had entered as fast as my legs would take me. I scrambled under the fence and back to my knees as fast as I could with several sets of footsteps chasing after me. After what felt like 10 miles, I couldn't muster up the strength to look behind me. After another mile, the sun had finally broken the horizon and several strands of light poked through the thicket. I finally allowed myself to stop and take a breather. I collapsed at the base of the tree, finally allowing myself to feel the intense burning pain in my side and the throbbing coming from my now mostly clothed arm. I slowed my breathing and began to cry. I bawled my eyes out for what felt like hours when I felt some more air puff up onto the nape of my neck. I flipped around and landed on my back, staring back at me. Hands and feet firmly planted into trees was that thing, smiling as brightly as it had at Grant. I scrambled away and picked up the closest rock to me before holding it like a weapon. The thing began to chuckle at me. It felt warranted the more I thought about it. What was I going to do with a rock? I dropped it and fell to my knees, arms outstretched. I clenched my eyes shut as tightly as possible, waiting to die. When nothing happened, I opened them to lock eyes with the creature, still smiling. In a moment, it had an entire claw on my stomach and was lifted above the ground by my neck. I tried to let out some sort of noise, anything that could tell anyone where I was. Nothing. No sound emerged. I looked down again to watch it rip downwards and my stomach and entrails piled at its feet in a wet clump. In a moment, everything went black as I could feel myself being dropped onto the forest floor. There was no light at the end of the tunnel, and there were no pearly gates. Only a never-ending sea of black. Before everything else followed into this abyss, I could hear it say in a hoarse few words,
"Don't tell a soul."
Everything followed into the dark. I was alone, forever falling and flying, everywhere and nowhere at the same time, before everything crashed back around me. I woke up. Not only was I alive, I was home. I was back in the trailer staring out the window as my mom had the same screaming match with her newest boyfriend of the week. I rolled off my bed with a splitting headache, as if all the pain had rushed back to me in an instant. I curled into a ball and began clenching at my head as the argument raged on in the background. All in a moment, it went away. I was left on my dirty bedroom floor covered in sweat. I looked down at my arm to find a scar stretching from the inside of my elbow to the base of my wrist. As the bottle smashed against the wall, I lifted my shirt to find another scar. In the days that would follow, Jimmy would go missing. The police never cared that much when he disappeared. My best guess is they stuffed his file in a drawer to never see the light of day again. And soon enough, the community of Bronze Acre Meadows would forget about him. His things were auctioned off by the park owner, and an ad was placed back in the paper. His memory was relegated to a place of a drug-addicted cousin that no one wanted to talk about. One day he was there, the next he wasn't. And this story had a lot of other narrators who helped me bring to life, so let me tell you who they were, in order of first appearance. Narrated by me, 242. Mom's Boyfriend by Evil Outcast. Mom, aka Jess, was by Dark Little Voices Decay. Jimmy was by Dark Little Voices Shade. The main character was As the Raven Dreams. Grant was Count Julius. And lastly was The Creature by Phoenix Fire. And please remember to check out these other narrators. All their links will be in the description box / show notes. My teenage daughter woke me up to check her teeth were still there, which they were, because she said it felt like they'd fallen out while she was sleeping. At her orthodontist appointment a week later, she tried to say, "I told you so," but struggled, giving most of her teeth were now hanging from the braces just removed, already rotting from how long they had been detached from her gums. And with that, my friends, our time together is coming to an end. As always, I would like to thank the writers who let me read their stories. The one about the dogmen, and like all ones that are exploring forest, reminds me of when I was a kid and going exploring the woods behind the house I grew up in. I never found anything too bad out there. No wildlife, nothing that wanted to eat me. But I also never really looked for cryptids or anything to get myself in trouble. I was really outdoorsy as a kid. I really loved being out in nature. As for the second story, I completely get the temptation for that money. Whether or not you come from a good home, 25 grand is quite a bit of money, especially for just a simple little artifact that you have to go steal. It's just sad that the creature and the cult were seemingly waiting for them, expecting them to show up almost like they were set up for a sacrifice. But I could be overthinking it, and it could have been happenstance for all I know. And of course, I'd like to thank the narrators who lent their voices to bring this story to life. Please check them out, and when you do, tell them 242 sent you. Please remember to share this podcast with anyone who might enjoy it. And if you're on a platform that allows it, please leave me a review. And if you're on Spotify, I now leave questions on that one specifically that you can answer, or even some polls that you can answer as well. If you like to help this podcast in other ways, I do have Patreon, where you get early access, or if you'd like to do a one-time donation, I do have PayPal and Buy Me a Coffee as well. All the links, including the ones to my socials and website, are in the show notes, guys. But as always, guys, thank you so much for just listening. It always has and always will mean the world to me. Sleep tight and don't let 42 bite.